Wednesday, August 12th, 2015, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are Missouri School of Journalism colleagues Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, Ferguson, one year later, what's changed, what hasn't, and how the media is, in a lot of ways, still at the heart of this story. Megyn Kelly tells viewers her response to Donald Trump's horribly sexist remarks is not to respond at all, yet it's still a lot of what we're talking about almost a week after that debate. And the weather. It's the one story in a television newscast that affects everyone. It's one of the reasons that we, as journalists, devote so much time to it. But there are a handful of local forecasters who say the networks are blowing out coverage, sensationalizing seasonal temps, and turning every storm into the storm of the century. But before we get to that, let's start with this little tidbit. At this very moment, the Washington Post has two reporters facing criminal charges for doing their jobs. One is in Iran. One is here in Missouri. We've told you about Jason Rezaian. He's on trial for espionage in Tehran. We expect to learn his fate within the next week or so. And on Monday, just as the statute of limitations was about to expire, prosecutors in St. Louis County formally charged Wesley Lowery with trespassing and interfering with a police officer in connection with last year's incident at the McDonald's. The Huffington Post Ryan Riley, also arrested that evening with Lowery, was charged formally as well on Monday. And while neither was necessarily surprised, both voiced concerns that if they were going to be formally charged and the county was going to proceed for what happened at that McDonald's, what else is going on? Who else is being charged and with what?
You know, I mean, police have discretion, wide discretion, when it comes to situations like the one where the reporters were in. But what message are they trying to send at this point? I mean, they're stepping all over themselves by doing this. They're taking the focus off of what they have done in the police department and what they've done in the city to try to improve things since the shooting. So this sends a really stupid message to me.
No, I'm with you on this, Mike. I read it and I kept reading other stories about it, and most of the stories on our links blog, and I just could not understand why the prosecutors in this case decided to go through with this. I mean, they could have easily just dropped it.
And why not just let it go?
Right, and in fact, when the police chief of Ferguson decided to let them go, he basically said, look, you know, we're probably not going to pursue charges in this matter. And here we are a year later, and they're pursuing charges.
At the 11th hour.
And to me, I, having worked with police and prosecutors as a journalist and going through the process with them, my thinking on this is that there were some police officers who pushed this through to the prosecutors. They're trying to send some sort of a message, but I can't understand for the life of me what that message is.
Was there anything maybe that you had seen in some of the anniversary coverage that perhaps there was a last-minute decision for retribution or reason where that might have come into it? Because it seemed to me, at least, a lot of that anniversary coverage seemed pretty fair.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of that coverage was actually giving the police departments and municipal courts some credit for what they've done over the course of the last year. This throws some of that, and I won't say all of it, but it throws some of that back into the bad light that they were trying to move away from.
Yeah, this is just part of, you know, a larger picture of journalists basically being fair game now for this kind of thing. But look at that case from Germany. I mean, it finally got dropped, but those two bloggers who were writing about surveillance in Germany were being investigated for treason until some smarter government officials jumped in and pulled the string on that one. But journalists no longer have the protection of being there to cover events for the public as an excuse. Government officials are willing to go after them.
Yeah, and when you look at that case, I mean, they were asked to leave private property. Now, I'm also wondering whether or not the McDonald's may have pushed this case, but I doubt that very seriously because that brings bad light upon them. So I keep going back to the fact
that McDonald's was a refuge, frankly, for a lot of working journalists.
No, exactly. And I keep going back to the fact that maybe it was some police officers or maybe it's an overzealous prosecutor, but it just doesn't make any sense to me why you would pursue this case.
So while you're on the subject of talking about police officers, an incident that happened here in Columbia, just a couple of blocks down the road downtown, the head of the police union posted something on social media in support of Darren Wilson, declaring Sunday Darren Wilson Day. Again, the union, not the police department itself. And that became a national story right there.
Again, I don't understand. Why would you do this? Okay, you support him, but you put it on you put it on your website of, and then he comes back and he says, well, this is something that the St. Louis Police Officers Association had done, and we were doing that in response to what they were doing to show our support for this police officer. That's fine. If you want to show support for Darren Wilson, that's okay. But to post it on your website and with very little explanation as to why you're doing it, and then expect nothing to happen in return, that just makes no sense to me.
I mean, I think in this instance, perhaps the official who posted it really didn't care what the ramifications might be in terms of how it made the city look, because I suspect what the CPOA is trying to do is to get more officers to feel like that's the group that should be representing them. We don't know, at least from the reporting I saw in the Tribune, how many members of the Columbia Police Department are actually part of the CPOA. So it could have been, you know, a recruiting effort. Now, they have the right to write and say whatever they want to, but they really should think about whether or not that was worth the trouble.
And there was another story that was in the Tribune that sort of gives some history to this, because there's this back and forth between the city administrator, the city manager, and the police chief, and the head of the police union. And there's a history there of this sort of antagonistic behavior toward each other. And now the city manager is saying, well, we're not going to present any kind of bond or petition to
more officers on the street. We're not going to support that or ask the public to pass new taxes to pay for that.
As long as this guy is a president. And so now it's been escalated even further. So, I mean, I just think that there needs to be some meeting or negotiation or arbitration or whatever you want to call it, because I think eventually it's going to hurt the police department and it's going to hurt the citizens.
So let me put this to you and ask you to put on your editor's hats. As this friction between these two groups, the city, the union, and its leaders, they're kind of bringing this back to a head again. If you're the editor of the newspaper, if you're a news director at the television station, at what point do you continue to cover that conflict, that friction between the two, and at what point do you let it go? I've been looking at the stories that have shown up on the Columbia Missourian, on the Columbia Tribune, on KOMU's Facebook page, and stories that would normally get somewhere between, I don't know, if you're lucky, between 3 and 10 comments. Last time I looked at the story on the Tribune, it had 85 comments on there. Do you take it for the web traffic and keep feeding it to the people, or do you let them... It's kind of a political ping pong game, and at what point do you stop covering it and let them just fight it out?
I mean, it's tough because you're kind of trapped into covering a story when there are that many people are interested in it and talking about it. I mean, you can't just let it go. I mean, it's kind of similar to what we're going to talk about with Trump. I mean, you know, the media have some responsibility to try to cover the news seriously, but how do you ignore something that's got so many people talking about it?
I mean, in the case of the CPOA and the city, I think that that story may have died down a little bit, but when the city manager comes out and says, look, I'm not going to push for a bond to hire more police officers as long as this guy is the president, I mean, you've got to cover that story
because it's
a public safety issue. So now you've got that, and I'm sure it's going to come back again once they start talking about the city budget, because CPOA, as they do every year, is going to ask for more resources for officers, and now you're going to have that clash again.
So, Mike, you talked a little bit about the people want to hear about it. I've often heard it referred to as kind of that Howard Stern effect. People don't necessarily want to hear what he's going to have to say, but they want to hear what he's going to say next and can't really turn it off because they want to know just how far is he going to push it. Well, maybe that counts for some of the 24 million people who tuned in Thursday night to watch the Republican presidential candidates battle it out on Fox News. And if you've read the polls, it looks like it was a good night for some of those candidates, becoming household names in ways that they weren't before. Some of them including Carly Fiorina, who held her own during that early debate session, the ones that people were calling the kiddie table debate. But little of what anybody else had to say was heard over the talk about Donald Trump. Maybe there's a bit more truth to what he told CNN's Chris Cuomo yesterday morning, that the biggest whiner gets the most attention and the one with the most attention ends up winning, because that's ultimately what he did. He whined about that question that Fox's Megyn Kelly asked him about his comments that he had made previously on social media and in other places about women. When he was asked about it on CNN on Friday, here's what he had to say.
She gets out and she starts asking me all sorts of ridiculous questions. And, you know, you could see there was blood coming out of her eyes, blood coming out of her wherever. But she was, in my opinion, she was off base. And by the way, not in my opinion, in the opinion of hundreds of thousands of people on Twitter.
Hundreds of thousands. Well, crazy as that sounded, Trump came back on Twitter himself, clarifying that remark you just heard, saying that when he said wherever, he meant her nose. Funny, I watched that debate, and Megyn Kelly did not have any blood coming out of her nose. There is no question about that. She says she's not going to respond, but by saying on her own show she's not going to respond to me, that's a response.
Yeah, it's a response. I mean, she's basically saying that I'm not going to go down to your level. At least that's my interpretation of it. And I think what you see here from Donald Trump is he started out by basically saying disparaging things about Mexican immigrants. Then he's even doubled down on that, and he's saying disparaging things about Megyn Kelly and Rosie O'Donnell, which he did in the
O'Donnell's been going on for years,
but he brought that back up again.
That was his flippant response when she asked about the question.
And so I think he's making these statements as this is his way of campaigning. He's not campaigning on the issues. You hear very little about him from the issues. He'll talk about an issue, but no policies about how he's going to make changes or do anything. He just goes on and continues with these disparaging comments and outlandish behavior.
You know, I mean, Amy, I'm with you. I think we all know what he really meant when he said that. But I also think that it's not a slip of the tongue or that somehow he's calculating this. And when you talk about the fact that he says it just in such a way that he can walk it back and have some plausible deniability. But, you know, I think he's pulling like the Newt Gingrich did in 2012, except he's doing it a lot better. He's whining, as you said. He's attacking the media. And that's working at this stage in the campaign. I mean, look what's happening in the polls with voters in Iowa and New Hampshire. It seems to be working for him.
You know, we've talked a lot in the past about how journalists will often take that low-hanging fruit and tell the easy part of the story. I think in a lot of ways that's what we're seeing right now with Donald Trump continuing to lead in the polls. When you talk about how he's not campaigning on the issues, he's grabbing for that low-hanging fruit, and that's what the electorate is able to very easily understand. They're hearing what they want to hear. Something else that I found very, very interesting, listening to Cokie Roberts Monday morning talking on Morning Edition on NPR, mentioned that back when she was in the game full time, if a candidate wanted to appear on a Sunday morning talk show, as Donald Trump did on all of them Sunday morning, there was an expectation that they appear in person. Yet he's doing all of these interviews by phone. And producers and the networks seem to be okay with that. The rules have really changed, and we're allowing him to determine the rules of the game for us.
I think that's what's happening. I mean, it's not just Donald Trump. I mean, you know, at some point, at least I don't know when this is going to happen, he's going to flame out. But I think he has set the tone for how the candidates in 2016 are going to deal with the media. They're going to deal with the media on their terms. You're going to talk to me when I want to talk to you. You're going to talk to me in the setting that I want to talk to you in. And so we in the media have sort of lost the control in that area. But I still think that at some point the media has an obligation to the public to hold these candidates accountable for the things that they say, and either their policy statements or non-policy statements about the issues that are going to be important for the election.
I just think it's kind of the classic prisoner's dilemma. I mean, Trump has the leverage because the media let him have the leverage, because no one will step outside of the norm and say, we're not going to give him this kind of attention. We're not going to allow him to play us like this. I mean, I think what the media could do is what we heard from Marco Rubio when he was interviewed on Meet the Press this weekend, and he was asked about Trump. He says, if I comment on everything he says, my whole campaign will be consumed by it, and that's all I'll do all day. Well, that's what the media are allowing themselves to do. It's all Trump all the time because they're letting him play them.
So, Mike, what about Fox at this point? They're kind of in this weird position trying to stay on Trump's good side, yet also defending Megyn Kelly and standing behind her and what went on during that debate.
Yeah, and I'm not sure that how long that strategy can last. I mean, of course, they're going to step up and defend one of their stars. But, I mean, Roger Ailes, I mean, made it public that he wouldn't call it kissing up to Trump. But they had an understanding, let's put it that way. But, you know, Megyn Kelly, and especially the more she's involved in things like these debates, of course, she's a conservative darling. But she could get a job as a news anchor in a lot of other places that would pay as much money.
And there are a lot of rumors that some of the other networks are looking at her and talking to her. Let me read you the subhead on a column that was published in the Minneapolis Star Tribune this week. Quote, when former University of Minnesota athletic director Norwood Teague abruptly resigned on Friday amid sexual harassment complaints, some wondered if other shivering-inducing tales would emerge. I knew of one more, mine. And that's the end of that subhead. Those are the words of sports reporter Amelia Reno. And the piece goes on to detail how the two went out for a drink. She viewed it at the time as cultivating a source. He didn't, though, and this wasn't the first time he had crossed the line with her, and it wouldn't be the last. Her story is shocking, and I encourage anyone who hasn't already read it to take a look at it on our links blog. But it's not unique, and the level of sexual harassment that has gone on in newsrooms and among sources, it's a part of the business and ultimately drives a lot of women out of the business. One of the things that's interesting is we work as newsroom managers to create a non-hostile work environment. And while things may be very comfortable for everybody in the newsroom, we can't protect our reporters when they go out in the field.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, I the more I read the story, the more I kept thinking in my mind, why wasn't this discovered somewhere else? I mean, I can't believe that he did this in Minnesota and didn't do this at his previous job at Virginia Commonwealth. I get a sense that this is something that has sort of followed him everywhere. And I think it's that silence of, well, maybe somebody else will report it, or maybe this is going to have an impact on my job, which he talks about. She says, you know, I was afraid to come out and say anything about this because I was afraid that I would lose my sources within athletics, that it would hamper my job, that I would have to change from sports to something else, which I really didn't want to do. And those kind of restraints have the ability to allow people like him to continue to do what they're doing.
Yeah, I mean, I really do empathize with the reporter, and I'm glad she came forward and told that story. I do think, you know, she was right to sort of ask herself why she didn't come forward sooner, despite, you know, her concerns about what might happen to her career.
Right.
Because this harassment had been going on for a while.
Years.
And it seems like the tipping point was basically when the guy was trying to acclaim in this harassment of the interns, that it was basically, you know, he was drunk. Right. And so it was a one-off kind of deal. And she obviously knew better. But, you know, there is one other thing about this story that I find interesting, though. I wonder why the paper let her do the reporting on the original story 3 days before she came out with her own piece without acknowledging it at all.
Especially knowing, too, that there had been the discussions with the human resources department that she had towards the end documented everything that it had been researched and that there was evidence within the company that it
Had happened. Yeah, well, I got a sense that human resources knew it, but maybe she hadn't given them the permission to
share
that information with her supervisors. And I think once this came out and she basically told her story to a wider audience within the newsroom structure, that a lot more of this came out. That was the sense that I got.
I guess the other thing, too, that you raised was how do we protect our reporters, and maybe we can't. I mean, you know, we've seen the stories coming out of Jeff City this past year about harassment. And, you know, I can tell you, as a former editor of one of our news organizations, there have been many times when we couldn't protect our own student reporters down in Jeff City from that very same kind of thing.
Well, bit of a shameless plug. I am the advisor of a new student organization that's starting up this semester here on campus called Mizzou Women in Media that is going to work to support our students and members of our community who face issues like this and help our women working in newsrooms here and across the country really kind of support one another in these situations and look for ways, if it's even possible, to limit them. So if anybody's interested in learning more about that, there are some links on our links blog for how to get in touch with the Mizzou Women in Media. So as for our next topic, on the surface of things, it seems like a pretty unlikely partnership. investigative reporting powerhouse ProPublica and the online review site Yelp. What are they doing here?
I had no idea Yelp even did healthcare ratings, which is kind of interesting. I saw, you know, restaurant reviews for the most part, but basically they're teaming up so that they're combining the people who are reviewing healthcare facilities and with the data that ProPublica has gathered from government sources, so you can not just have these sort of anecdotal accounts of what might have happened with this particular facility or provider, but you can match that up with real data. And so, I mean, it sounds like a pretty good idea, although I can imagine a couple of difficulties with it.
Yeah, I think one of the things that they need to really stress, both Yelp and ProPublica, is that this is just a starting point. That if you're going to use this information, you need to use it in a way that's going to lead you to even further information about a facility that you may want to use. And in that way, I think this is a good partnership for both ProPublica, Yelp, and those who use those services.
Well, and I think that's, I would hope at least that anybody who's going on Yelp, even looking for a restaurant review, you're going to get people who have dated reviews. You're going to get people who have such a horrible experience or has it out for the proprietor that they're going to leave some horrible, horrible reviews. I suppose that could happen in this situation, too, if somebody has a bad experience with a doctor or with a hospital. Perhaps this does bring some balance to that conversation.
And I think the one important thing is that both Yelp and ProPublica are going to have to make sure that that information is updated as regularly as possible. And when you're working with governmental agencies, there's always a time lag. Mm-hmm. So you're going to have to be careful about that. And that's one of my huge concerns about this partnership, especially involving you know, assisted living facilities and that sort of thing.
And I'm just a little worried about ProPublica because Consumer Reports a couple of years ago did a look at Yelp and Angie's List and some of these, and they had a lot of criticisms for the way that those services operated. So I hope that, you know, ProPublica is careful that it doesn't have its brand tarnished by some of that.
Okay. Well, we all have family members who live spread out across the country, and when there's bad weather, we all have a tendency to worry about their safety, especially when we turn on the network news and hear a weather event described this way.
All signs point to a dangerous night and weekend ahead for millions of Americans across at least 13 states. We're entering what is anticipated to be a multi-day outbreak of violent storms. It will bring lightning, strong winds, hail, flash flooding, and as many as two dozen tornadoes. Al Roker is watching several spots at risk right now. Al, what have you got?
Well, Lester, we are seeing a very volatile situation right now. We're watching strong storms approaching Louisiana into New Orleans, 8,000 lightning strikes in less than 10 minutes. We are also seeing some very strong storms developing. The areas in yellow are tornado watches. The areas in red, tornado warnings, especially in Kansas right now, a very dangerous situation.
So that was from April 24th of this year. My first thought when I heard this was, as many as two dozen tornadoes. Like, we both, or all three of us, know enough to know that you can't predict if is it going to be one tornado? Is it going to be 32 tornadoes? They spawn, they disappear. But that's creating a culture of fear right there.
Yeah, it is. And I think a lot of it is this whole thing about the, you know, the national media has become focused on weather because it draws eyeballs in.
I mean, everybody's going to get wet if it rains.
Yeah. And people want to know, okay, you know, how bad is it going to get? So now you have the national media predicting that there are going to be these mega storms. And when they don't happen, you know, all of a sudden people are going like, well, wait a minute. You told me yesterday that I was going to be prepared for this and it didn't happen. And now I don't know who to believe.
You know, I mean, I applaud these local weather people who are coming out and saying the networks need to stop doing this. But it is kind of ironic because local TV news, generally speaking, has hyped weather forever and ever. And that's why the networks are seeing that success and saying, let's try the same thing. I mean, can we all say snowpocalypse?
Snowpocalypse, yeah. Snowmageddon.
Yeah. Right.
Every cold snap is not a polar vortex.
And now all of a sudden they're starting to name every storm that comes across the country. They give it a certain name.
That's a Weather Channel and an NBC initiative right there. And it's creating this sense like it's August. It gets hot. We're lucky today. It's not super hot. It's not super humid. But when it's 90 degrees 3 days in a row in August, it shouldn't be the deadly heat wave that we're seeing in so many places.
No, I think you're right. And what they need to go to is thinking about weather in the long term and not the short term burst of whatever apocalypse you want to name it.
The hype kind of reminds me of Bill Murray as Dr. Peter Venkman in Ghostbusters, where he's talking about, you know, the city is going to be in for Armageddon of biblical proportions, right? Dogs and cats living together, mass hysteria. That's kind of what it reminds me of.
Sharknado, it's a storm with teeth. Regular listeners and viewers of this program know we often use audio and video clips from those news programs that are on Comedy Central. Stephen Colbert and Jon Stewart had a way of providing perspective and context that's too often missing in traditional journalism. It came during Stewart's farewell program last Thursday night, ironically airing opposite of that Republican debate on Fox, a challenge.
So I say to you tonight, friends, the best defense against bull is vigilance. So if you smell something, say something. We'll be right back.
That's a great challenge. Not so clear, though, if that challenge was to the general public, to the media, or to both.
Certainly applies to both. And you know, I mean, I think Stewart has become a lot more than a comedian. I have to say, though, in watching that show, I was a little disappointed. I mean, I remember when Stephen Colbert did his last episode, it was hilarious. And this was kind of, this is a long, let's get everybody who's ever been on the show to come out and say something. But it wasn't really all that funny, except for when Stephen Colbert came on to, and kind of said what he had to say about Jon Stewart. So I think he sort of transcended humor. And for one night, that's okay, as last night on the air. We could probably take that lesson to heart about the word we can't say on the radio. Yeah.
The if you smell something, yeah, say yeah. something.
I mean, I think that last part was the sort of classic Jon Stewart, and yeah. the rest of it was everyone paying homage to him, and that sort of took away from it. I think everybody was probably looking at that last episode saying, we want to see, since we're not going to see Jon anymore, mm-hmm. we want to see more of Jon and not all these other people. Yeah. But they got that in the end, so I think it sort of worked out there.
It's interesting to see as those shows come back with new hosts in the next few weeks, if we're going to get that same level of analysis and context and the if you smell something, say something.
Yeah, I mean, I have no idea how Trevor Noah is going to do, whether he's going to have anything like the same sensibility. I mean, I wish him – somebody needs to be doing this. I think maybe it's more likely to be John Oliver over at HBO, who has been tackling
Which
these kinds of big public policy.
That is a fantastic show. The problem with that one is it doesn't necessarily have that same reach that you have on Comedy Central right. because of the HBO pay situation.
Right, right. And I would not be surprised if you didn't see John Oliver sort of move back toward the television that can reach a larger audience that's not HBO, because I think what he brings is a lot of what people fear is going to be missing now that Jon has stepped off stage.
I mean, Colbert could do it, but I'm afraid the platform he has to do it over, you know, on the Late Show is just he's not playing a persona anymore, so I don't know how he can work
that in. He's not playing the persona, and he doesn't kind of have that cushion that cable gives you, that little bit more latitude that you don't necessarily have on
network TV.
Yeah,
and there's certain expectations in that, a certain format that they follow that. Mm-hmm. I don't think that CBS is going to allow him to change very much.
Well, we're just about out of time for today. You can read more about the topics we talked about on our links blog. That's under the programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, ask us questions, leave comments, see what we'll talk about next week, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show and to Trevor Harris for handling the audio. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.